Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. Be reading from the spring 2011 issue, Remembering the Civil War. And the first article that we'll read today is called A Soldier's Life. It was written by Randall Garrison, who at the time of the publication had taught English for 28 years for Burke County Public Schools, holding BA and MA degrees in English, his G teaching certificate, and National Board certification. He served as a part-time instructor at Western Piedmont's Community College. He's been a reenactor with the 26th North Carolina Troops, reactivated for 22 years at that time, with the rank of major, and previously edited the group's Company Front magazine. This is a fictional account based on historical sources. Will awoke with a startled jerk, as he most always did. He still wasn't used to being in the canvas A-frame tent with three other, sometimes snoring and often smelly, comrades. Not that he didn't snore or have his own unique smells, too. The field musicians sounded like they were right inside the tent, as their fifes and drums loudly called the men to morning roll call. The sergeants' voices began rousing the nearly 1,000 soldiers from the 10 companies of the regiment. Will remembered that he and his tent mates needed to be dressed and in front of their tents on the company street by the time the tunes making up reveille ended. Will pulled on his brogans in the gray light of dawn, making sure the right shoe was on the right foot. This is the first pair of shoes he had owned that had a right and a left. He slipped into his stylish 9-button shell jacket, found his kepi, and mashed it on his head, and crawled out of the tent. He immediately headed to the camp sinks to relieve himself. His friends in the tent were getting dressed, too. Complaints such as, "Watch your elbows and get your knee out of my back," could be heard through the tent's open flaps. Will hustled back to his company street and fell in along with nearly 100 other groggy men. The first and second sergeants started wrangling the men into two rows or ranks. When the two lines became about equal in length, the first sergeant, with a gravelly voice, ordered, "Attention, company, in two ranks, right face, size march." The taller men began moving forward as the shorter ones moved back. Will always found this lineup a bit funny. In battle, it could mean that the taller men on one side fought the shorter men from the opposing force. Will measured about average height, so he usually ended up near the center of the company. The first sergeant then gave the order to front and cover down. This formed the file, two men, one in front of the other, for the rank and file. On the one end of the front rank stood a private who was nearly 6 feet 5 inches tall. On the left flank, the final private was a shade over 5 feet. Will and friends around him joked quietly as the roll was called. Several men fell out to report to the surgeon. Usually there were only a few sick, lame, or lazy. No soldier wanted to visit the surgeon unless he was really, really sick. The doctor had too many ways to hurt a man. Unclean water, crowding, lack of food, and other conditions did lead to lots of illness in camp. More Tar Heels died from disease than battle. The sky grew brighter quickly in Crabtree Valley. Smoke hung close to the ground, a sure sign of rain later. Will hoped so, at least. Rain was about the only thing that might get the troops out of company drill. It would need to be a heavy rain. Will kept on hoping. Soon the sergeants dismissed the men for morning mess. Will and his tent mates quickly headed back to the tent to get their breakfast ready. Two potatoes, a highly prized onion, and some slab bacon were soon cut up. The bacon hit the frying pan first to make grease for the taters and onions. Will squeezed into a spot by the one fire allowed to the company. He nestled the frying pan down over red-hot coals. Friendly banter and cooking advice drifted back and forth across the fire pit, and the bacon was soon ready. Will divvied it up into four mess plates at his feet and turned his attention to cooking taters and onions. One of his friends brought out a small sack of salt, and Will used some to season the food. There was no coffee today. Supplies had gotten scarce since coffee came mostly from the north. Will and his friends did break out some hardtack crackers. The men devoured the meal, washing it down with canteen water. In almost no time, the field musicians had their wooden fifes shrilling away again, accompanied by the side and bass drums. They sounded first call. The men of the 26th North Carolina Troops had 15 minutes to clean their plates and pans and then put on their gear in preparation for the morning dress parade, followed by drill. The gear, or accouterments, cooters, consisted of a waist belt, bayonet and scabbard, and a cap pouch. Cartridge box slung over the shoulder and held down by the waist belt, canteen, and most importantly, a rifled musket. The 26th had just been issued new Enfield rifles made in England and delivered into Wilmington by daring blockade runners. The weapons were the finest, most modern available, and Will loved his. It could hit a target easily from 300 yards away or more. The only items that the men left in their tents were haversacks. These tarred canvas bags held a few personal items an 18-year-old might possess, such as a comb, a toothbrush, a spare shirt, some clean socks, a housewife, a soldier's name for a sewing kit, and a small Bible. Will's bag also contained several letters from home, including one from a special young lady that he read every night. Haversacks stayed in the tent because they were not needed for drill. They would just be extra weight. Will fell in with the company I-men and watched as morning parade, quite a sight, formed. The entire regiment lined up for the colonel's inspection. The color guard, the sergeants who guarded the flag of the regiment, were placed or posted in line first. Captains then led out the two center companies to form on the right and left of the colors. The rest of the companies followed in order. Will was always fascinated by the mathematical precision of even the simplest movement. The process felt like a dance with 1,000 armed men. Morning parade offered even more military ballet than forming the line. The field music trooped the line, passing back and forth across the face of the whole regiment. The adjutant, an officer who was an assistant or aide to the colonel, opened the two ranks by bellowing, "Prepare to open ranks, to the rear or open order." The rear line moved backward three steps, and the officers checked the dress or straightness of the line. The lieutenant colonel and major double-checked the dress. All the officers moved forward into their positions ahead of the companies and wings of the regiment. The adjutant reported to the colonel and then called the first sergeants front and center to report each company's numbers of men as presumed or accounted for. Soon the adjutant sent the sergeants back to their places, and the orders of the day were read. Will groaned inwardly. Drill, drill, and more drill. It never changed. Drill meant practicing all the maneuvers that a regiment or a company might be ordered to attempt while marching or in battle. With the company split into small, manageable groups, drill time began. First came what they called the School of the Soldier. Will knew most of this drill by heart, but a fair number of men, some of them new, had trouble remembering the commands. Some did not know left from right. The nearly 10-pound musket felt awkward, but after much repetition, most of the movements came naturally. Right shoulder shift. Shoulder arms. Order arms. The first sergeant and his assistants were not easy to please. Every movement must be just right and done together in unison with the other soldiers. Will's right arm felt an inch longer than his left because they practiced so much. Simple marching or moving from two ranks into four ranks was complicated and needed to be perfected as well. Right wheel, left wheel, by the right flank, by the left flank. Sometimes drill commands sounded like a foreign language, but the men learned. Loading and firing the rifle in nine commands, also known as load in nine times, was one of Will's favorite parts. The soldiers had seldom actually fired their guns, however, due to a shortage of powder and caps. Sometimes the first lieutenant or the company captain would give the orders, but usually they hung back as observers. The sergeants and other non-commissioned officers gave most orders. After about 2 hours, the school of the soldier ended. The troops began company drill, led by each company's officers. The men practiced more marching and maneuvering. Willen noticed that company drill was basically the school of the soldier with bigger groups. The troops practiced commands such as on the right by file into line, left turn, and right about until they were thoroughly tired. Noonday mess was announced by bugles and the field music. Will and his pards relaxed for an hour, cooked a dinner just like their breakfast, and complained about drill. Unkind remarks about the officers, especially the slim aristocratic colonel who headed the regiment, made the rounds. Real combat would soon prove the wisdom of all this practice, but the men did not know that yet. They would find out at the Battle of New Bern that drill saved lives. The afternoon included skirmish drill, where the soldiers practiced spreading out and advancing in the front of a main line of battle, firing in pairs in charge with uncovering the enemy's lines. The day ended with battalion drill, as the whole regiment went through the maneuvers practiced throughout the day. Rain finally arrived, but it only canceled the evening parade and made the supper mess a real mess. Soon darkness fell. Will crawled into his tent, going last since he slept on the end closest to the flap. He took off his wet shell jacket and brogans and rolled up in his big, state-issued wool blanket. He was sound asleep and snoring before the field musicians finished their regular evening tunes. What you've just read is a fictional account of the daily, somewhat boring, and physically demanding life of a Civil War Confederate soldier in a training camp near Raleigh. Much more time was spent in drill than in battle, and Will's story would be a common one. Constant research of historical primary sources, especially diaries, letters, and journals, helps modern-day reenactors such as the large 26th North Carolina Reactivated Group recreate the soldier's experience every time they take the field. Read more about the real 26th North Carolina troops and the 26th North Carolina Reactivated at 26nc.org. Several other reenactment groups exist across the state. Who knows? One day you might help keep these wartime memories alive as a reenactor. Here are the captions that accompany the photographs for this article. Modern reenactors set up tents the same way that Civil War soldiers did. Sergeant E.C.N. Green of Wake County wore this kepi. Green was killed at Gettysburg on July 1st, 1863. Reenactors with the 26th North Carolina troops reactivated go through a morning dress parade. During the Civil War, soldiers in camp lined up in such a parade for their colonel to inspect them. Field musicians passed back and forth in front of the regiment before orders began. Orderly Sergeant Alfred May, Company F, Trio Guards, 61st Regiment, North Carolina Troops, used this oilcloth haversack with leather straps. Soldiers sometimes marched 12 to 15 miles a day, carrying all their gear and weapons. May's regiment fought in Virginia, Eastern North Carolina, and South Carolina. It took part in the final major battle at Bentonville. Civil War soldiers spent more time in camp or marching than in battle. Religion, music, the reading and writing of letters, and games helped pass the time. It's a photograph of some dominoes from around 1863. And also, there's a flugelhorn belonging to Oliver J. Lehman of Forsyth County, a musician in the 33rd Regiment, North Carolina Troops. Music was important to Civil War soldiers. It signaled parts of their day, relayed battle commands, lifted spirits on long marches, entertained troops in camp, and consoled those in field hospitals. Band members sometimes played other roles, such as ambulance drivers. See what else you can learn about music of the era. And the Confederate Grays, Duplin County, later Company E, 20th Regiment, North Carolina Troops, are pictured here. circa 1861. There's also a photograph of reenactors from the 26th North Carolina troops reactivated doing a drill. There's a sidebar article that Randall Garrison wrote, and it's called Joining Up. And there's a little section next to it that says, what is a regiment? Confused about lieutenants and sergeants? For information on Army ranks and Army organization, as well as battles fought in North Carolina, access ncmuseumofhistory.org/exhibits/civilwar/resources.html. Will and several pals jogged down the dirt road toward town on a cool June morning. They were in a hurry. Today something very exciting was happening at the county courthouse. Not a trial, not a hanging, but recruiting. A company of local men was being gathered to go off to fight the Yankees. Will had just turned 18, and his friends were a bit younger. They could not remember being ever so excited. War. They could become heroes. Girls would swoon at their feet when they returned home in handsome uniforms with medals. At the stately columned courthouse, the group ran into a crowd. Everyone in the county, it seemed, was there. The growing crowd pressed in toward a stage set up on the front lawn at the base of the main steps. On the stage sat the mayor, several aldermen, and young men in uniform. Will recognized one of the young men. Sam, the popular son of the wealthiest man in the county, had been off at school in Chapel Hill. Now he was back, dressed as an officer. One slender, dark-haired man in uniform on the mayor's left radiated authority. The two men checked their pocket watches just before the mayor motioned for musicians to play. Three fifers and two drummers, plus a bass drummer, performed a rousing 15 minutes of music. The same tunes likely had stirred the hearts of would-be volunteers 90 years earlier during the American Revolution. The mayor thanked the musicians, introducing them as belonging to the 6th North Carolina Regiment. Some men from Will's hometown had joined that unit, raised about 5 months earlier in May 1861. The mayor gave a short, enthusiastic speech about the need for this gathering. He introduced Captain Sam Williams. The military board in Raleigh had given Williams the authority to raise a company of 100 men from the county and surrounding area. But rather than give a lengthy fire-eating speech, Williams introduced Major Abner Pettigrew, military official's choice to travel through the state and deliver recruiting speeches. Pettigrew began by outlining the state's hesitance towards secession in 1860 and its movement towards secession after Fort Sumter in South Carolina was fired upon. Pettigrew spoke of the Confederate victory at First Manassas in July 1861, explained the naval blockade of the coast, and began a fiery description of federal troops' invasion of Tar Heel soil. They were encamped in the state's eastern region right then, he said, biding their time before moving west. By the time Pettigrew finished, the crowd had reached a fever pitch of emotion. Pettigrew gave the invitation to join Company I of the 26th North Carolina troops, soon to start training at Camp Crabtree near Raleigh. There was a mighty surge forward, and Will found himself swept along. One of his friends tried to stop him. Will, your ma's going to kill you. You won't have to worry about the Yankees. Before Will knew it, he stood in front of a wooden table, attesting to being of sound mind and body, and signing the oath of allegiance to the military. It seemed very official and more than a little frightening. Will was guided to a tent he had not noticed. A small, beady-eyed military surgeon examined him and asked him odd questions. Did he possess 10 fingers? Could he see out of both eyes? Did he have all his toes? And most strangely, did he have 2 front teeth that met, one top and one bottom? Will had all his teeth, fingers, and toes, so the doctor cleared him quickly. He went to stand in a 2-row line of men accepted for service for the duration of the war. Will had a lot of hard and sometimes mightily boring training in his future, but then his regiment would be sent to serve under General Robert E. Lee as part of the Army of Northern Virginia. There would be no romance. The brutal truth would be that tens of thousands of soldiers like Will would die in the bloodiest of America's wars, the Civil War. The next article is United States Colored Troops Fighting for Freedom, written by John H. Haley, Ph.D., a retired history professor who last taught at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. An elaborate ceremony took place February 7, 1998 in Southport. Modern Civil War reenactors representing both Confederate and Union troops honored the memory and rededicated the graves of two veterans of that war, Abram Blunt and Abraham Galloway. Blunt, a 20-year-old formerly enslaved man from Hyde County, enlisted in the 37th Regiment, United States Colored Troops, USCT, on December 10, 1863. In the final stages of the war, 18-year-old Galloway, born a slave in Smithville, now Southport, enlisted in the same regiment. When the war ended, both men settled in Smithville. Upon their deaths, each was buried there in John Smith Cemetery. Few soldiers in history better understood the goals for which they fought than African Americans, often called colored people at the time, who joined the Union Army during the Civil War, especially after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. These men knew that the war's outcome would mean the difference between slavery and freedom for African Americans in the United States. Risking capture or even death, free and enslaved African Americans sought refuge within Union-occupied territory in northeastern North Carolina. They flooded areas including Plymouth, New Bern, Beaufort, and Roanoke Island, which fell under federal control in early 1862. Often referred to as refugees, freedmen, or contraband, these African Americans provided valuable service to the Union as spies, pilots, messengers, guides, and laborers. They also served in the United States Navy and as recruits for USCT units. Before the establishment of the National Bureau of Colored Troops in May 1863, it was reported that freedmen near Beaufort were drilling with weapons they had purchased for themselves. In New Bern, they had formed their own militia, and on June 19, 1863, the first company of USCT raised in North Carolina, and quite possibly the nation, was organized as an element of Colonel Edward A. Wild's proposed African Brigade. The brigade's first regiment of North Carolina Colored Volunteers was based at New Bern. That town's Colored Women's Union, for the benefit of the Colored Brigade, paid for its battle flag, inscribed with the word Liberty. The Christian Recorder, a publication of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, reported that the colored people of New Bern were glad to cooperate in the defense of freedom. The African Brigade did not develop as originally planned. Its major units were later designated the 35th Regiment USCT, 36th Regiment USCT, 37th Regiment USCT, and 14th U.S. Colored Heavy Artillery. USCT recruits came from a variety of states, so these units were not exclusively made up of native North Carolinians. Perhaps the best known of African-American troops was the 54th Massachusetts Infantry. The 1989 movie Glory told part of its story. At first, African-American troops faced racial discrimination and prejudice from both the United States War Department and white Union soldiers. Colored troops received less pay and fewer food rations than white soldiers. They were given inferior equipment, and they were often required to perform servile labor for white units. They could not become officers unless they were chaplains, clergymen, or medical doctors. Besides, black soldiers had no guarantee that if captured, they would be treated properly as prisoners of war. They were more likely to be killed or condemned to excessive hard labor. They could also be returned to slavery. The number of African-American recruits from the Tar Heel State steadily increased during the war. John Randolph, a former slave from Washington, North Carolina, wrote in July 1864 that he hoped the heroic deeds of colored men on the battlefield would show the world that we are deserving of the rights and title of citizens, a people worthy to be free, worthy to be respected. Units formed in North Carolina participated in a variety of combat or combat support operations and missions in Maryland, Virginia, South Carolina, Florida, and Texas, as well as in their home state. Their performance equaled that of other units. Occasionally, USCT members receive recognition, including the Congressional Medal of Honor, the nation's highest decoration for bravery in combat. The gigantic Union naval and army forces that invaded North Carolina near Carolina Beach in the winter of 1864-1865 included at least 9 USCT regiments. Seasoned veterans who had fought in the battles of the Wilderness, the Crater, and New Market Heights in Virginia made up some of these regiments. Once ashore, they took part in attacks and other combat engagements that led to the capture of Fort Fisher and the surrender of Wilmington. USCT units were among the victorious Union forces that entered that town on February 22, 1865. Approximately 6 weeks later, on April 3, 1865, 36th USCT, formed in North Carolina, enjoyed the distinction of being the first Union infantry regiment to enter Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederate States of America. After the surrender of General Joseph E. Johnston's Confederate troops near Durham on April 26, 1865, USCT units participated in a grand Union victory parade in Raleigh, reviewed by General William T. Sherman. Along with their combat role, USCT units often thought of themselves as liberators and carriers of culture. They established churches, schools, lodges, and literary societies. Their very presence in an area offered vivid testimony to the end of slavery and the beginning of a new social order. The Christian Recorder reported that during the parade that followed the surrender of Wilmington, colored people, young and old, crowded the streets, cheering and exclaiming, "The chain is broken, joy, freedom today." Sergeant N.B. Sturt of the 39th USCT asked one elderly African-American woman if she was glad to see black troops. She replied, "It seemed like the good Lord had opened the heavens and handed you down in answer to my prayer." Another woman reunited with her son, who had left his home a slave but had returned in the garb of a Union soldier, free, a man. Colored troops also gained knowledge and leadership skills that became useful later in life. For example, David Chapman of Pitt County enlisted in the 37th USCT in 1864 at age 17. Chapman was discharged as a sergeant when the war ended. He settled in Brunswick County, where he became a civic, educational, and religious leader. For him, as for so many others, the Civil War changed everything. Here are some photo captions. This reunion of members of the 35th U.S. Colored Troops, 1st North Carolina Colored Infantry, took place at the Prince Hall Masonic Lodge in Plymouth around 1905. Soldiers from Company E, 4th U.S. Colored Infantry, posed at Fort Lincoln, Washington, D.C., shortly after the Civil War. The unit was among those that saw action at Fort Fisher and other North Carolina locations. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.